Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program.
Thank you for joining us on ABC Digital, the World Wide Web, and Radio Australia. ABC Local Radio not with us tonight. They're off the cricket. But we shall have a good time amongst ourselves. In just a moment, I'm going to introduce you to an interview we first broadcast around Easter time with Washington journalist E.J. Dionne. This week, Kevin Rudd named Kim Beazley as Australian ambassador to Washington. There's been much media comment on Beazley's expertise in defence and his interest in United States history, as indicative of his affinity with the current United States administration. What there has been little or no comment on is the religious sympathy Beazley shares with Rudd and Obama. Beazley, like Rudd, is an Anglican with an interest in theology. Obama's links to his local pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, became part of the grist of last year's election campaign. Obama's serious interest in the theology of the Christian realist Reinhold Niebuhr was recounted in an interview between David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post, a discussion which was held at Georgetown University in the United States in January. Following that interview, or perhaps around the same time actually, E.J. Dionne wrote a book called Sold Out about Obama, religion, and the politics of the United States. We got to talk with EJ around April this year, after the election, after Obama had time to settle in, and reflected on Niebuhr, religion, politics, and the United States. And in just a moment's time, we'll go to EJ Dionne. E.J. Dionne, welcome to ABC Radio.
Good to be with you.
It's interesting that immediately prior to the G20 summit, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, the Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, chose as their major public platform St. Paul's Cathedral, where at the invitation of the St. Paul's Institute, they presented their case to the world. Now, these are prime ministers who not only express a faith, but have a serious intellectual commitment to that faith, something that they share with President Barack Obama.
Yes, I think that we have gotten so used to the idea that wealthy societies are secularized that we've forgotten that religious faith has not been secularized away. We have also gotten so accustomed to the idea that religion lives mainly on the right or comes at us in a fundamentalist sort of way, although that's a complicated word, but I think most people know what I mean, that we have lost sight of a very rich social tradition in Christianity that in some ways goes back all the way to the very beginning, but was certainly very present when, with the rise of industrialism in Britain. The joke is that the Labour Party owes more to Methodism than to Marx, and there's a lot of truth to that. And Gordon Brown very much represents that kind of R.H. Tawney Christian socialist tradition. Kevin Rudd has spoken and written about his deep admiration for Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German saint, even if he has not been formally declared one by the church, who rose up against Nazism and was put to death for his opposition to Hitler. And so I think that there is sort of passing through the industrial world this new, if you will, progressive engagement with religion that is also very much part of Barack Obama's worldview.
The irony is that it appears we have the religious right to thank for it.
Right. There are some ways in which that's true. I think that there may have been a general reluctance to bring faith commitment to public life before the rise of the religious right. Now, my own view is that the religious right's view of the Christian tradition is somewhat distorted, and it narrows the focus of Christianity to a few issues, matters like stem cell research and abortion. They're very serious issues, but in doing so, they many, not all, but many on the religious right pushed aside the teachings of both the Old and New Testament about the poor. My friend Jim Wallace, a socially committed evangelical in the United States, likes to say that if you cut everything Jesus said about the poor out of the gospel, you'd have a gospel full of holes. And so I think, yes, the religious right kind of forced religious moderates and progressives to be more comfortable expressing their own faith in public. And I think certainly in the United States right now, you are seeing a very interesting ferment among religious conservatives who themselves, partly in response to the religious left and partly from their own reflection, are putting more emphasis on the obligation of Christians to the poor, more emphasis on the need especially to help people in the third world, to deal with the problem of AIDS in the third world, to deal with human rights questions. So there is, I think, a better conversation generally. I think the religious right may have done a service to the religious left, and I think the religious left has returned the favor by pulling the religious right to a broader set of commitments.
Yes, this is a politics. This emergent politics is different from the battle between the secular left and the materialist right. Rudd and Obama seem to be returning to a modified progressivism, almost Wilsonian in the years before World War One. I mean, perhaps as an alternate to neocons and neo-libs, we could call them neo-progs.
Neo-progs is not bad. In fact, Tony Blair, who is also an open Christian, recently converted to Catholicism, very openly linked himself to the American progressive tradition, more Teddy Roosevelt than Woodrow Wilson. But I think that's true. I think there's another sort of parallel debate that's been going on between individualists and communitarians. And I think that on both the right and the left, there is a bit of a revolt against a radical kind of individualism that downplayed community commitment, that downplayed obligations, spoke much more of rights than obligations. This new disposition, this new communitarian disposition, is still broadly liberal. It still believes in individual rights, but it emphasizes also the obligations that those rights carry, and it emphasizes the importance of building community, and indeed a community itself as an underpinning for the rights we hold dear. So that I think that this secular debate between individualists and communitarians has been enriched by the rise of a strong communitarian feeling that comes out of our religious traditions.
Yes, there's also a recognition of the limits to utopian dreams.
Very much so. And I think this is where the great American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr comes in. Barack Obama is someone who can talk about Niebuhr at great length. He was a left Protestant, began life as a socialist, became more of a New Deal liberal, but is said to have introduced liberals to the idea of original sin. He once jokingly said, and to his credit, he credited the line to the person who first said it, but he made it popular, that original sin is the only empirically verifiable doctrine of the Christian church, that we can always see the human failings around us. And whereas some traditions, both liberal and left, sort of emphasized the perfectibility of man, Niebuhr emphasized the importance of our fallen nature and the need for politics to take that into account. He was a great aphorist, Niebuhr, and he once said that man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible. Man's capacity for injustice makes democracy necessary, which is to say that democracy is a beautiful dream that comes out of idealism, but democracy also believes passionately in checking excessive power. And given fallen human nature, you always have to be wary of excessive power, whether it's in the state or in certain parts of the private sector.
This is an interesting framework, which is shared by these leaders that they bring to the floor of the G20 summit. I mean, it enables them to introduce an agenda which includes things like the poor of the world and climate, linking them to centrally economic discussions. That is, these things haven't fallen off the back of the cart.
Right. Well, the Catholic Church has this lovely idea, and I am a Catholic, of a preferential option for the poor, and that when you look at social policy of any kind, one of the first issues you must grapple with is how your policy affects the least among us. And, you know, the great religious traditions carry this notion that every human being is endowed with dignity and is worthy of respect as a creature of God. That is, in its way, a very powerfully egalitarian idea. And I think that's why I view Christianity in a deep sense, and also the Jewish scriptures, particularly the prophets and the book of Exodus, as revolutionary creeds in human development. And then on the environmental side, this has been particularly common, actually, among conservative evangelicals in the United States. A significant group of them have begun to talk about the obligation of human beings to what they call creation care, which is care for God's creation. We have been entrusted with stewardship of the earth. And in their view, that leads to a commitment to doing something about global warming, because if we allow global warming to destroy God's creation, we are not living up to our obligations as stewards of the earth. Again, I think this comes as a surprise to a lot of people who are more secular progressives, who don't always see these kind of commitments coming out of religious citizens in Australia or in the United States, but they are very much there.
You're on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, Washington Post columnist and fellow of the Brookings Institution, E.J. Dionne. E.J., let's talk a little about the cliché of the religious right. You've sensed the emergence for some time in American politics of a progressive left and the demise of the religious right. You take it back as far as 2004, when the neoconservatives began to overreach themselves.
Right. I think that you had a very strong reaction against the Bush presidency after the 2004 election. Some of it is explained by the administration's failures in dealing with the damage caused by Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans and in that region. Some of it arose with disaffection from the Iraq War, that the Iraq War was sold as an enterprise that would be a lot easier than it turned out to be. Some of it arose from the president's efforts to cut back on or privatize parts of our Social Security system, which ended up being very unpopular. And we can go through the list. But the disaffection with President Bush, I think, went beyond Bush himself to a kind of questioning of conservative ideology among a broad swath of the electorate, not only those who had been against Bush from the beginning, but also among a lot of middle-of-the-road voters and even among a fair number of conservative voters. I think that kind of washed back onto the religious right, because President Bush himself, he was is a sincere evangelical Christian. He was very much associated with the Christian right. And so I think this questioning of conservatism as a creed led to a particular questioning of the Christian brand of conservatism, which, it should be said, is sometimes allied with neoconservatism, but sometimes quite distinct from it.
And there had been a very strong intellectual tradition underlying the religious populism on the right. I mean, there are people such as John Richard Newhouse, Paul Weyrich, both of whom incidentally died shortly after the election of Barack Obama, who had been the intellectual driving force underpinning the emergence of the religious right.
Right. Richard John Newhouse, Father Newhouse, as he became, was a fascinating, fascinating person. He started life as a Lutheran and on the left. He actually ran as an anti-war Democrat for Congress during the Vietnam War. And over the years, partly because of his strong opposition to abortion and then from a sort of larger intellectual journey, he came to question ideas of the left. Father Richard's interesting, as he was known, because in some ways he was anti-liberal from the left before. He was more of a radical than a liberal. And so there was almost a natural flow of his ideas from, you know, rather left of center all the way over to the right. He wrote a book back in 1984 called The Naked Public Square, which asserted that, and it's a book that influenced some of the religious left as well, and it asserted that that religious people could not be legitimately denied their place in the public square in a pluralistic democracy, that religious people had a right to bring their religious convictions to the public debate, to the democratic, small d democratic debate.
parallels the line of another leading commentator on the right, Michael Novak, with his origins on the left with the Religion for Radical Politics back in the 60s.
Right. Well, I've been friendly with both Novak and Father Newhouse, and I told Mike, I never got to say this to Father Newhouse, but I told Mike Novak recently that he, and I wrote this in my book, actually, that he and Father Newhouse helped persuade me to many of the views I now hold, which in most cases are views they now reject. Michael Novak, a very important Catholic thinker, wrote a book back in the 60s called The Theology for Radical Politics, and he too drifted right during the Reagan years, and I think, again, the milieu of Reagan, you know, the effect Reagan had on politics in general was not lost on either of these men. Mike Novak became an ardent defender of the free market, wrote a book in the early 80s called The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism. And so, yes, you did have this drift of these figures to a religious conservatism, and they did give it a kind of intellectual heft. There's one other thing I think that's worth bringing up, that from really the time of prohibition in our country when we prohibited alcohol and arguments about evolution back in the 1920s, I think there was a tendency of the dominant culture to treat fundamentalist evangelicals with a very considerable disrespect. H.L. Mencken, our great, you know, the journalist and satirist, was very rough on the not-so-well-off religious folks from the countryside, particularly from the South. And I think the rise of the religious right was in part a rebellion against being put down by the dominant culture. Nathan Glazer, a great sociologist, spoke of this movement as a defensive offensive on the part of these religious conservatives. They were trying to fight for their place in the public debate. And so with people like Novak and Newhouse, they had very strong intellectual defenders of their claims to respect.
This also led to a quite remarkable piece of practical ecumenism. I mean, conservative Catholics, Protestants and Jews came together with more in common than with their co-religionists in their own faith traditions.
That's absolutely right. And I think it's a kind of ecumenism that has spanned the entire political spectrum, that it began on the right with Catholics and evangelicals who were at each other's throats. It's worth remembering that many evangelical Christians who later allied with Catholics on issues such as abortion or aid to religious schools were the very people who in 1960 said we should not elect John F. Kennedy as president of the United States because he was a Roman Catholic. And what happened is not that they suddenly all reached agreement around the Nicene Creed, but that they discovered a new set of issues that engaged them, particularly the question of prayer in public schools, which was banned by our Supreme Court in the United States, abortion, stem cell research, homosexuality. This, in turn, brought about another kind of ecumenism on the left. And funnily enough, Father Newhouse was at the center of that back in the days of the Vietnam War. He helped form an organization called Clergy and Laity Concerned About Vietnam. And you saw this broad alliance across the left, across the religious sphere, of progressives who were opposed to the Vietnam War. And that also grew into ecumenical action around human rights issues, around social justice issues. Sometimes I wonder whether this is simply the triumph of politics over religion.
Well, indeed, it leads inevitably to what have been called the culture wars. That is, religion is shanghaied into a debate that's not necessarily its own.
That's correct, and it sometimes worries me that, you know, you go far afield from religious concerns and that political concerns become your primary object. C.S. Lewis had a nice line on this, where he said, you know, we don't search the scriptures to see what Christ had to say about political problems. We ransack the scriptures for support for our own political party, and there is a lot of that going on, I think, honestly, left, right, and center.
You suggest that that the apogee of this in the Bush years led to genuine conservatives being frustrated by the narrowness of an agenda, which was basically no to gays, abortion, evolution, climate change, but silent on wider issues such as poverty, the death penalty, wage justice, etc.
No, that's correct. The death penalty, it's very good you bring that up, because there was some polling done on this, and it's not surprising that when opponents of abortion are asked where their inspiration to oppose abortion came from, many of them say the inspiration was religious. But it turns out that in the United States, at least, a very substantial number of the people opposed to the death penalty also cite religious inspiration as a primary reason for their opposition to the death penalty. And I think that there has been, among some conservatives, a real sort of crisis of conscience where they change their position from support to opposition to the death penalty in an effort to create some consistency in their view on abortion and capital punishment.
This narrowness of the debate into sort of political and cultural areas, as I suggested, pushed many of the conservatives to question where they are at. You provide a brilliant illustration of that in your book Sold Out, when you tell a story about the faith-based initiatives and the disenchantment of the very man that Bush had brought in to run the faith-based initiatives.
Yes, David Kuo, well, John DiIulio and David Kuo are two very important figures. They're friends and they're people who genuinely care about the poor and are very devoutly Christian. And John DiIulio ran the initiative for 6 months. David Kuo came in with John DiIulio and then stayed for quite a while. And David ended up writing a rather angry book about his experience in the Bush administration, essentially saying that he came to the view that this initiative was being used far more for political purposes, to rally a political support, electoral support from evangelicals, than it was a genuine commitment of the administration. Interestingly, David lets President Bush himself off the hook. He says some kind things about President Bush, but he's very rough on the rest of the administration. And also there was the problem that while there was a lot of talk about this, there wasn't a substantial increase in funding for programs for the poor. Therefore, there was an enormous debate at the end of the Bush years as to whether he actually did increase support for faith-based social action at all. He may have moved some money around, but it's not at all clear that there was actually an increase in support for these organizations. I think it's very striking that Obama, President Obama's come in, and he has said he wants to continue these partnerships between government and faith-based groups. He wants them on sounder constitutional footing. He doesn't want to push the church-state boundaries as hard as Bush did, but he also wants to finance them. And I think it's going to be an interesting test of Obama's verbal and strong rhetorical commitments to religion's role in the public square. It'll be an important test to see how he does on the government faith-based cooperation front.
Maybe we can offer a cautionary note here. In Australia, the government outsourced to the church and charitable section and the provision of employment services on the basis that they were closer to the needs of people than the bureaucrats. Yet within a couple of years, the bureaucrats had begun to exert such tight control on the funding guidelines that the churches were prevented from value-adding their compassionate service delivery, and they effectively were reduced to government agents, which caused an immense reaction. So it's a very much a two-way street, this one.
Oh, no, it's a very serious issue, because it seems to me, on the one hand, you cannot have the state, certainly in the American tradition, you cannot have the state pushing one religion or another with government money. On the other hand, these organizations want to preserve their essential character. They want to preserve their integrity, and it's a very careful line you have to walk. John DiIulio and I did some work on this subject back in the 1990s, and we had a wonderful meeting that drew together people from all kinds of sectors, including very secular people and very religious people engaged in social service. And I'll never forget the man who ran the Gospel Missions organization. These were folks who worked in Skid Row in the poorest parts of the country, mostly with drunks on the street, and they were very committed people. And he got up in the meeting and he said, "Look, just so you know who I am, we're the people who hit you over the head with a Bible and pour soup down your throat." And he proceeded to say that he didn't want government aid because he was worried the government aid would get in the way of his preaching the true gospel as he saw it. So these lines are, there are not clear lines that say all religious people want government aid, all secular people are against government aid. It's a very complicated debate.
You're on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, E.J. Dionne, Washington Post columnist and fellow of the Brookings Institution, also author of Sold Out. EJ, let's talk for a moment about the characteristics of this emergent progressive movement. Key to this are a group of Protestant thinkers such as the evangelical Jim Wallis, you mentioned, who for almost 20 years have been working away at the fringes on this issue. But there are other names such as the Mennonite, Ron Sider, Tony Campolo, even Richard Cizik at the National Association of Evangelicals, although up until recently with the National Association of Evangelicals on Climate Change. These people have been drawing on a distinct history of Protestant progressivism that goes back, say, in England to Wilberforce or the Tappan brothers and Finney in the United States, on into the black churches and the civil rights movement. You mentioned the Methodists and politics. There's also a broad Catholic tradition from Leo XIII and Rerum Novarum in the 1890s. Wallis has been in semi-regular contact with Rudd, Brown and Obama for some time. There's a shared theologically informed discussion that's been developed here. Do you think the media is up to interpreting what's going on?
Well, having been in the media for such a long time, I guess my answer should be I certainly hope so. I think that it's been something under the surface, and I'm not sure that Rudd and Brown in particular are unhappy that it's been under the surface. I think that sort of religious engagement in politics is probably more controversial in Britain and to some degree in Australia, although you have the whole split in the Labour Party and a long history, a very interesting, complicated history of your own in this area. But I think they're not unhappy about that. I think the media, certainly here, has become much more aware of the existence of this religious left, partly because of Wallace's work, partly because of Barack Obama himself. One of the best and most powerful speeches any American politician has ever given on this subject is a speech that Barack Obama gave at a meeting organized by Jim Wallace's Call to Renewal group, where he laid down a whole series of markers. And what was very striking is it was a very balanced speech where he very much defended, Obama did, the role of religious people in public life, said they could not be excluded, they could not be required to give up religious reasons for their commitments. But he also, and this was important, I think, given the rise of the religious right, he very much defended the role of secular people, of atheists, and argued that even though religious people had every right to participate in the public square and base their views on religious reasons, they had to offer arguments to the broader public that were not specifically religious. It's not enough to say the government should do X because Jesus says so. And he spoke also a lot, obviously, about this compassionate tradition. So anybody in the media who wanted to miss this couldn't miss it anymore after Barack Obama had made such a big deal of it in the campaign. It should be said that Hillary Clinton also said some very interesting things. She is a very, very serious Methodist herself. So I think that there was a sort of rebirth of realization, if I can put it that way, over the last 4 or 5 years.
It's interesting that in coverage, say, of the opening of the G20 summit, the press gave a lot of attention to the event at St. Paul's Cathedral, certainly here in Australia and in the UK. Yet there was very little discussion of what the meaning of that was, that is, what it betokened.
That's very possible. I confess I did not see all of this coverage. Again, I think that the existence of religious progressivism, which was so obvious to people at the turn of the century in that of the last century, in that great progressive period, and was certainly very visible here during our civil rights movement, where the African-American church was in many ways the base of organization for the civil rights movement, that history kind of disappeared on us. We entered a much more secular period. The public discussion was much more secular. Prominent religious leaders used to be very important in that discussion. In the United States, people like Paul Tillich and Reinhold Niebuhr were on the cover of major news weeklies and the like. It's been a long time since that happened. It was mostly attention was mostly confined to a handful of leaders on the religious right. So that if this was ignored a little bit, I think there's a long history of reasons why it was ignored.
You mentioned that Niebuhr reintroduces us to the notion of original sin. He does that in the context of taking Christianity into the public square
quite deeply. That is, there's a deep commitment to the notion of Christianity as an agent in civil society, or even a civilizational role for Christianity, that much of Christian culture over the last 30 years, particularly evangelical Christian culture, has tended to ignore.
Right, although I think, in fairness, there have been evangelicals who, for example, took Niebuhr very seriously. But you're right, I think that there was a much richer sense of the interaction of religion and the civilization, religion and intellectual life, religion and political life, in Niebuhr's theology than there has been in some highly privatized versions of evangelicalism. There are times when, again, I don't want to make sweeping statements about evangelicalism, because there is a very serious intellectual tradition there, but certain versions of it became almost therapeutic and were much more easily assimilated into a therapeutic culture of the West, which is quite different from what Reinhold Niebuhr was talking about. Niebuhr was also, one of the things that made Niebuhr so powerful, I think, is that he preached a combination of passion and humility. It was a passion for public engagement, and he spoke of the obligation to public engagement, but he also spoke of the need for those engaged in the public square to question themselves, to question their own motives, to be wary of their own moralism. Niebuhr was a moral man because he questioned moralism and excessive pride. And boy, I think in politics it's awfully useful to have voices questioning excessive pride.
It's interesting that Obama is the one who introduces Niebuhr into the conversation. There was a quite remarkable little piece that you and David Brooks revealed to the world in a discussion you had at Georgetown University recently on Obama, in fact, initiating the discussion about Niebuhr with David Brooks.
David is a colleague and friend who's more conservative politically than I am, but we share this fascination and affection for Niebuhr. And David was interviewing Obama long before the campaign really got going. And as David tells the story, the interview wasn't going anywhere. He really didn't know what he was going to get out of it. And just for fun, he said, "By the way, what do you think of Reinhold Niebuhr?" And Barack Obama proceeded to give a rather lengthy, very detailed, and very informed answer about who Niebuhr was, why Niebuhr was important to him, why this emphasis on humility in the face of public choices and sort of a kind of useful self-doubt was important to him, important to Obama. And it took David totally aback. And then a while later, I was interviewing Obama. And it was actually during the whole controversy around Reverend Jeremiah Wright, his pastor, whom he later broke with. And he was talking about how one should look at the church itself as an inspired but human institution with human flaws. And then he interrupted himself and said, "If that's not a Niebuhrian thought, I don't know what is a Niebuhrian thought."
And it does play out directly into the political arena. I guess this is what I'm getting to finally, that we're here with a group of men who take these considerations about deeply personal commitments that apply ethically into their own behavior and then, of necessity, must play out in their political behavior.
It seems to me that if you take religious faith seriously, if you take the call of Scripture seriously, you cannot separate those entirely or even mostly from your public commitments. It doesn't mean you impose your faith on someone else if you're a politician, but it does mean that if your faith teaches you that a commitment to the poor is a central human obligation, and if you believe, as these more or less social democratic sorts of politicians believe, that the state has an obligation to lifting up the poor, it's impossible to say that your religious faith will have nothing to do with your public commitment. In fairness, I think it's entirely legitimate for those who believe their faith teaches them that abortion is murder to bring that commitment to the public square. And so I think that you have here three leaders who really thought a great deal about this. Gordon Brown is the son of a minister. He got this from birth. And I think there are lots of people out there who have been doing this for a long time, but they haven't been noticed. And suddenly you have some political leaders who give voice to that and offer examples of that kind of religious commitment.
It's interesting that it occurs at precisely the moment that neo-atheism is enjoying a sort of wave of renewed interest through Hitchens and Dawkins and others.
No, that's true. There are a lot of different ways to look at the neo-atheists. I think one way is to see them in part as a reaction to the rise of the religious right and also religious fundamentalism generally, including very radical forms of Islam. A friend of mine, who herself is an atheist, likes to see the neo-atheist as what she calls an overreaction to an overreaction. And her point is that, yes, there were abuses on the parts of certain kinds of fundamentalists, but that does not need to lead, as it does in the case of some of these neo-atheists, to an absolute hatred of religion or to an insistence that a religious faith always leads down a terrible and destructive path. And I think that the religious left is in some ways a useful counterpoint to the neo-atheists because it says, wait a minute, many of the things you assert about religion leading ineluctably to a loss of faith and reason or ineluctably to reaction, we, the progressive Christians and Jews and Muslims, we do not believe that's true, and indeed we are evidence that that is not true.
You're with ABC Radio, John Cleary with you, my guest E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. E.J., we're rapidly running out of time. Just a couple more questions, perhaps about yourself and the way you see things at the moment from your perspective. You grew up a Catholic and spent some time in the 80s as a Rome correspondent, observing the papacy of John Paul II and his German shepherd, Joseph Ratzinger. What's your assessment of both men and their impact on the sorts of issues we've been discussing?
Well, John Paul is a fascinating figure. I used to say to friends that sometimes the more Catholic I felt, the more I had doubts about John Paul's papacy, and the less Catholic I felt, the more I could understand his strategy. I think in the long run of history, his effect will be seen as more progressive than conservative, and I know that's a dissenting view. The reason I believe that is because in the end, he ratified the openings to the world, in the openings to democracy, to religious tolerance, to the importance of social justice that are the legacy of Pope John the 23rd. And I think this embrace by the Catholic Church of democracy and tolerance is one of the most important developments in human history and one of the best things that ever happened to liberalism. On the other hand, in certain ways inside the church, the people he tended to appoint were more conservative, and he was opposed to ordaining women, ordaining married priests. And so on these questions, he is seen as a conservative, and that is also part of his legacy. In the case of Benedict, Benedict's a fascinating and brilliant man. He, in some ways, I sometimes think of him as the first neoconservative pope, not that he supported the war in Iraq, he did not, but that the original neoconservatives arose were people who had moved from left to right, largely in reaction to the student revolt back in the 1960s. And I got to have a written interview with then Cardinal Ratzinger, and I asked him this question, and he was very candid in saying that it was the rebellion in the universities, this fear that certain parts of the student left had lost their respect for the role of reason in the university, that began to push him in a more conservative direction. I think looking at him at this point, there are certain things he's done that have made liberal Catholics very uncomfortable, notably his semi-embrace of the breakaway group that opposed the Second Vatican Council and all its works, including a Holocaust denier. The Pope has very much backed away from that.
Well, yeah, there was a confusion there. It seemed that, all right, you could understand intellectually where he's coming from, but there was a certain political ineptitude that this revealed as well.
Oh, absolutely. And at the very best, you could say he was poorly staffed on this issue. And he has had to apologize again and again for that. On the other hand, he has been a less militantly conservative pope than I think many liberals feared and many conservatives hoped he would be.
Well, indeed, Deus Caritas Est was a remarkable statement. It even came to terms with erotic love.
So I was just going to say that. I mean, to have your first encyclical be not something that read everyone out of the church, but rather as an encyclical called God is Love, sends a powerful message. His second encyclical was on hope. I joked at the time that Barack Obama, for whom the word hope was central to his campaign, should have gone around quoting Pope Benedict. So he is a complex figure, more conservative, I'm sure, than I am. And as I say, some of these moves I have been critical of, but he is not in any way a reactionary, and in principle also endorses Vatican II. Of course, the argument about the Second Vatican Council is how you interpret it, and that's where the fight begins, not ends.
And Ratzinger does seem to take this civilizational stuff very seriously. I mean, he's argued it out in the Forum of Europe very strongly.
Right. Well, if you take his famous Regensburg speech, in which he had a passage at the beginning that greatly offended Muslims and for which he apologized, if you cut that passage out and looked at the rest of the speech, it was a fascinating discussion of the role of faith and reason and the compatibility of faith and reason. And, you know, it's unfortunate that he had to use that Muslim example, the suggestion that Islam was in some deep and fundamental way opposed to the role of reason and faith. If he had left that out, he could have set off, and in some ways he has set off, a fascinating discussion of this.
And America can in some ways, or is in some ways, the fulcrum of this. I mean, the problem for Rome over many years, even going back to the great Leo XIII, is that as far as Catholics are concerned, you American Catholics are too culturally Protestant.
Right. When I was covering the Vatican, my friends there would say that we Americans are really Protestant. And I think all Americans, Protestantism is so deep in the American tradition, in the founding ideas of the United States, that all Americans are a little bit Protestant, including atheists, including Jews, including Muslims, and including Catholics. And this has brought the American Catholic Church into trouble with Rome. There was a heresy condemned, I guess, at the end of the 1800s or the early 1900s, called Americanism. We have our very own heresy. You know, this creates a lot of energy in the American church. I mean, the irony is that Rome sometimes gets impatient with American Catholics, and yet organizationally, in terms of church attendance, in terms of all of the institutions and civil society, American Catholicism is one of the, Catholics constitute one of the most vibrant wings of the church in the world. And I do think it's our interaction, the interaction of Catholic and Protestant ideas, that has actually strengthened American Catholicism.
E.J. Dionne, we are out of time. You've been very good to us. Let me ask you one final question, or for one final observation. Kennedy was the first Roman Catholic elected as President of the United States. With the Obama mania, particularly around the inauguration, there seemed to be the odd Kennedy-esque moment. Did that sensibility capture you in any way? And was there any particular moment during that inauguration that made you, well, there's a bit of a tingle up your spine in that sort of
deep
sense?
My wife and I took all three of our kids to the inauguration that day. So we were part of the 1.6 million or however many there were who showed up that day. And there were just a number of moments, the most powerful obviously being that our country began with slavery, popularly known as our original sin, and here we were inaugurating as president an African-American, and it was a way of turning our backs on a certain part of our history and embracing a new approach. It was kind of the culmination, as President Obama himself has said, of the promise of the civil rights years, but also the new engagement of Americans with politics. Voter turnout went up, activism of all kinds went up, and the number of young people who were out there that morning. Obama really is, like Kennedy, the candidate of the young. 68% of voters under 30 voted for Barack Obama. And you couldn't help but feeling this excitement and energy from the young on that day. And it helped contribute to that sense that we were embarking on something new. And let us pray that it all works.
There was one moment for me watching the concert at the Lincoln Memorial when Springsteen introduced a sprightly 89-year-old Pete Seeger to sing This Land Is Your Land. And from the reaction of the crowd, it was almost as though suddenly they'd been given permission to reclaim something of themselves that had been tucked away for a very long time.
I think that there is something to that. First of all, Pete Seeger had been, if not a communist, close to the Communist Party. He was banned from media for a very long time. And just his very appearance was a kind of rebellion against a certain style of McCarthyism. But he was also somebody very associated with the civil rights movement and the labor movement. But I think that there was always a progressive America that felt its own kind of patriotism. And I think that the left has always had, and I think that this is not true just of the United States, a kind of ambivalent relationship with patriotism, a worry that patriotism moves too easily to nationalism. And I think that, that moment and a number of moments during the Obama inauguration were the re-embrace of strong patriotic feeling by progressives. And I think that progressivism should of its nature be patriotic, not nationalistic, not chauvinistic, but patriotic. And you certainly had that feeling on that day.
E.J. Dionne, thanks so much for joining us.
It's so good to be with you.
When I was walking that ribbon of highway,
as I went walking that ribbon of highway,
this has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.